Biscuit I Will 138.
Hello, Cam.
G'day, mate. Let's just get Mike back in.
Hello.
All right, g'day world, it's Friday the 30th of June, the end of the financial year for 2006, at least in Australia. On the show today, special co-host Mike Seafang from Adelaide.
Good morning, and it's my 22nd wedding anniversary today, so congratulations to me.
Wow, congratulations, man, that's a long time.
It's a beautiful time.
And
congratulations, mate.
From the east coast of the United States, Rod Adams, host of The Atomic Show on TPN. How are you, Rod?
I'm great, Cam. How are you?
Good, thank you, mate. Now, I guess the rough topic for the show today is nuclear energy. Yet again, we revisit our subject of nuclear power. That's why we got Rod on to help us work through it. Because as our Aussie listeners will know, there's been a lot of discussion in this country over the course of the last couple of months about nuclear energy. The Australian federal government, Prime Minister John Howard, has formed a panel to investigate whether or not we should be ramping up uranium enrichment and nuclear power plants around Australia. And I guess the perspective from a lot of people in this country is it's a done deal already, that this setting up of a panel, an investigative committee, is really just for pretense, that they've really already decided that this is what they're going to do. And there's been quite a lot of public debate, the most public debate I've seen in years, here in the papers, on TV, on the radio, on the web, around whether or not we should have nuclear power plants scattered around the country. Now, obviously, that's, you know, during these times, there's a lot of fear mongering goes on about the risks of nuclear energy, etc., etc. And you know, no better person I can think of to come and help us figure that all out than yourself, Rod. Now, I was mentioning to you the other day that I happened to be catching up on West Wing, one of the good television shows. And there was an episode in the last series of West Wing that actually features the plotline features a nuclear power plant in California having an accident, and, you know, brings into they have the whole nuclear versus anti-nuclear debate on the show, which, you know, is done quite well. I mean, there's a lot of scaremongering done in there, but then one of the presidential candidates, played by Alan Alda, comes out and says, you know, stuff that I've heard you say a lot of times before, Rod, that, you know, in the last 30 years there hasn't been a major nuclear accident, and how many people do you think have died from coal mines and oil refineries and related accidents in that period of time, you know. So there were some of those arguments put forward in a fairly popular television show, which was good to see. So, Rod, I know you've been doing some reading around the Australian stuff in prep for the show. I mean, what's been your perspective on the debate that you've seen so far?
Well, it looks like some of the same topics that come up on a regular basis have been talked about. I've got a page up from, I guess, your age paper that has probably 50 to 100 comments on it. And some of them are very well thought out, and others are not so much about fear-mongering as they are saying things like, well, we don't need nuclear power because we can simply save our way to riches and prosperity by just conserving what energy we have. And I don't understand necessarily, when I get involved in talking to somebody, how they think that we already have energy when we have to keep pulling coal out of the ground and oil out of the ground and oceans and all that other stuff every day in order to just continue living our regular lives. I've lived in places where there isn't enough energy. I've spent a lot of time out on sailboats in the open ocean. I hike in the mountains and carry just a little bit of propane with me, and I understand how you can live with very little energy, but man, I wouldn't want to live that way all the time.
Yeah, I guess that the fear that most people have is, you know, since I guess Hiroshima, we've all been indoctrinated with this view that, you know, radiation, nuclear radiation, causes terrible sorts of birth defects, and can cause, you know, not just birth defects but cancers inside of people. You can die from this sort of stuff, and there's sort of the horror visions of horror stories that we've all been indoctrinated with, and it's genuinely scary stuff. And it's, you know, I think again in the West Wing somebody brought up the argument, yeah, but if there's an accident in a coal mine or in an oil refinery, you know, you don't have 1,000 years of contamination in the place, and, you know, generations of birth defects that come out of it. Mike, what sort of bait have you heard about it from down in Adelaide? Have you been following it?
Haven't been following the bait that closely, but being a bit of a physicist myself, I just have these back of the brain unfounded fears about dirty great long half-lives, as you were just alluding to. And I know the people that I talk with about this stuff think, yeah, well, the half-lives are so long, we better spend more time figuring out what the long-term effects of all this stuff are. But I think that's a viewpoint half based in ignorance, I would suggest.
Well, I understand the concerns, and when people want to listen and they ask me about what do you do about long half-lives, the fact is that we really do have an answer for that. The long half-lives that people talk about are in almost 100% of the case isotopes of materials that are left over that still could be used as fuel in other reactors. The long half-lives that are left over come out of plutonium, uranium, and things called transuranics, americium, and a bunch of other very high weight atomic isotopes. But all of those can still be split by hitting them with neutrons. If you keep them in a reactor, they will eventually break. Once they break, the products that are there are short-lived to the point where they're completely gone within about 300 to 600 years.
So why do we have all these arcane procedures and processes for dealing with the waste? Why don't we just bomb them and make them safe and put them down the garbage disposal?
Well, we're not going to put them down the garbage disposal, first of all. One of the things that's pretty amazing about the leftovers from a nuclear power plant is that it's so compact that we really can carefully store it, inventory it, and watch over it. We know exactly where all of the waste material from all of the nuclear power plants that have been operated in the world still is right now. You can't say that about oil, coal, gas, because their waste products are so voluminous, they have to be released to the environment. Ours are stored in carefully controlled containers.
Cam, your thoughts?
Well, you know, I've been reading a lot of the arguments that people have on the web, and, you know, there's obviously a lot of concerns about the waste products from nuclear energy, and there's a lot of people talking about the long-term repercussions of that nuclear waste and what we do with it and what could happen if it leaked out. But as you say, Rod, I mean, it seems to me on the surface of the arguments that I hear that this stuff is pretty well encased and taken care of now, if it's managed under, you know, responsible management.
Well, and because of the nature of the beast, the management at nuclear power plants is a bunch of very careful people. Now, I'm not saying you have to be the smartest person around to be involved in the operation and maintenance of a nuclear power plant, but you have to have a certain dedication and a certain desire to do the right thing. At least in the U.S., the screening process to get those jobs is pretty intense. The jobs, once you get them, are pretty well-paying jobs. They're not something you can get rich at, but people with high school educations and technical, you know, training a couple of years worth of schooling after high school are making close to six figures in the U.S. And each of our power plants employs between 600 and 800 people. A similar sized oil plant employs maybe 80 or 90 people.
Okay, so it's good for employment rates as well.
It is. It's very good for employment because what happens? Go ahead.
I was going to ask, does a nuclear power plant and an oil refinery produce a similar amount of power?
Well, a nuclear power plant and an oil power plant, and we do still have some oil power plants in the U.S., not terribly many, but we have some. But roughly speaking, a large nuclear plant will be between 1,000 and 1,600 megawatts per reactor. And we have one station in the U.S., which is probably one of the world's largest electricity stations. It has three power plants on it, each of them producing about 1,400 megawatts, and that's a nuclear plant. An average-sized coal plant in the U.S. is somewhere around 1,000 megawatts per unit, and there may be as many as four units on a single site.
Okay. So I guess the other concern that I read a lot about is the fact that the people seem to make a connection between nuclear energy and nuclear weapons, and that uranium mining is at the basis of both of them, and that if we are mining more uranium, it's going to lead to us selling that to other countries like Korea and China and who are going to end up in India, who are going to end up producing nuclear weapons out of it as well. I mean, but you have to kind of somehow we have to draw a line between those two discussions, really, don't we?
I think it's worthwhile to draw a line, but here's something that many people have no concept of, is that in the U.S., over the last 10 years, our commercial nuclear power plants have used up the material that was left over from a bomb-making machine in Russia. And we've consumed the equivalent of about 8,000 to 10,000 warheads worth of Russian uranium over the last 10 years.
Wow.
And that was material that used to be warheads. So we are, with our nuclear power plants, destroying warheads. And there's no other way to get rid of that material.
Yeah.
Other than to break it up in a reactor.
And use it. I guess the other thing that I think is very pertinent to this discussion is the way that it's not... We can't just compare, you know, the dangers of an accident at a nuclear power plant that runs amok to the accidents with, you know, oil power plants, oil refineries, all this sort of stuff that goes along with fossil fuels. It's the damage that we're doing to the planet because of fossil fuels. I mean, we're looking at climate change. Al Gore's film seems to be doing very well in terms of reaching people on this at the moment. We're looking at just the damage to ecosystems where we mine this stuff, although I don't know if mining uranium's any less damaging to ecosystems. But then the damage of putting, you know, carbon-based toxins, or the breakdown of carbons up into the atmosphere and what it's doing to the ozone layer, climate change, etc. As opposed to nuclear energy, which, at least from that perspective, is very clean and greenhouse gas friendly, right?
Well, as you know, my background in nuclear energy is as a submarine officer in the U.S. Navy. If it's clean enough to run inside a sealed submarine full of people, it's pretty clean. It's not producing any gases. And it's not just greenhouse gases to worry about. I mean, coal-fired power plants produce things like acid rain. They produce sulfur dioxides and nitrous oxides and smog and fly ash that kills people who are sensitive with asthma and that kind of stuff. There's an awful lot of stuff that goes up the smokestack. Remember that power plant size that I talked about? If you have a 1,000-megawatt coal-fired power plant, it consumes about 11,000 tons of coal a day and produces 45,000 tons of carbon dioxide every single day.
Hmm. And I,
and a nuclear reactor produces nothing.
Yeah. And there's, and as you said, with that acid rain, there's some radioactive isotopes I read that coal produces when it's burnt. Some radioactive isotopes of carbon, which, you know, go up into the air. So, you know, burning coal actually puts more radioactivity into the atmosphere than a nuclear process does, as far as I understand it.
Well, there's not only the radioactive carbon, the carbon-14, which is a normal part of coal. Actually, most coal is pretty well decayed in terms of carbon-14, but the most coal deposits in the world have between 2 and 4 parts per million uranium and thorium in them as a natural contaminant of the coal. Now, that doesn't sound like very much, but if you burn 11,000 tons of coal per day, at that rate, you start to have kilograms worth of uranium and thorium going out the stack.
Now, I read an article, Rod, up on Greenpeace's site talking about how Spain is now the fourth European country to begin to phase out nuclear energy and looking at moving towards wind and wave power and stuff like that. Now, my understanding had always been that it was too hard and too unreliable to rely on wind and solar and wave to produce energy, and that, you know, which is why we've stuck with coal for so long, one of the reasons anyway. And but why are these countries phasing it out? Do you have any background on that?
Well, Germany decided to phase out nuclear power plants, I believe, in 1987, right after the Chernobyl accident. As of right now, I believe they have shut down one plant. So 20 years later, they are still operating almost all the plants that they built. Sweden is in the same category. They decided by referendum in about 1980, I believe, to shut down their nuclear power plants. And so far, they've shut down a grand total of one, and it was a very small one that was built in the early days of nuclear power, so it was pretty much an obsolete plant to begin with. They have a couple other plants that they're talking about shutting down, but their industry is rebelling because they know that as soon as they shut down a plant, they're going to have to import more power. Generally speaking, it's going to be coal-fired power from Denmark or new nuclear power from Finland, their neighbor, who's building a new nuclear power plant.
Well, this article that I'm reading, which you know, is on Greenpeace, so it's obviously got a slant to it, but it says renewable energy is now taking the lead, with a single source such as wind energy adding more than 6,000 megawatts to the European grid every year, the equivalent of two large nuclear reactors. In only a few years, wind power in Spain has grown to 8% of the national electricity production. In 2005 alone, some 1,680 megawatts of new wind power were installed, generating four times as much electricity as the Zorita nuclear power plant, which Spain closed last month. You know, should we be looking at wind? Is wind clean? Are there any downsides to wind?
Oh, we're certainly looking at wind. And unfortunately, though, if you read many sites from other, well, I should say many people are not careful about telling you the difference between wind capacity and wind production, because the best windmill sites in the world can produce roughly 25 to 30% of the nameplate capacity of the plant because of the variations in whether the wind is blowing or not blowing and how fast it's blowing. If you are having a plant that is designed to produce full power at, say, 20 knots of wind, and the wind drops to 10 knots, it's producing 1/8 as much power as it was at 20 knots.
Yeah, and being a windsurfing addict, I feel the pain of that equation. The other perception about wind, too, is the relative efficiencies and overall volumes just aren't there yet. It's you got a fairly ugly scarring of the landscape for a fairly trivial amount of input back to the grid on balance.
And if I'm also a sailor, thing. And one of the things that really bugs me is when people look at, you know, a little bit offshore and say, well, we'll just put the windmills out there. Well, I sail out there. I don't really want a 417-foot tall windmill stucking up my air.
One of the other things.
Sorry, I'm selfish that way.
Yeah, one of those other one of the other things on the Greenpeace site, which I thought was interesting, they're claiming that all across the world, the nuclear industry is drowning in debt, controversy, and its massive waste issues. It is only kept afloat by the likes of Blair and Bush, who are pouring billions of dollars of public money into an industry which reached the end of its life over a decade ago.
I guess Greenpeace doesn't know how to analyze stock market figures for companies like Exelon and Dominion Resources and Entergy and Florida Power and Light Company, or has ignored the fact that recently British Nuclear Fuels, BNFL, sold their nuclear power plant division, which is known as Westinghouse. When they put it on the market in the summer of 2005, they expected they would receive approximately $1.8 billion. When the sale closed in January of 2006, Toshiba was the winner with a bid of $5.4 billion.
So you're saying that the debt is part of the plan, it's manageable, they're not drowning in debt? Are the nuclear company, I mean, what kind of companies run these sorts of things around the world in the US? Are we looking at Halliburton and the usual bunch of guys? Is it GE? I mean, who runs these things?
The producers of the power plants are General Electric, Westinghouse, and Areva, which is a French company. Those are the ones in the U.S. There's also a company called BWXT.
They make them, but do they also like run them and manage them? Are they you know, usually standalone public corporations that run them?
In the U.S., there's a separation between the manufacturers of the facilities and the operators. The operators are companies like Exelon, Florida Power and Light Company, Southern Company. They're all electric utility companies. However, over the last 10 years or so, the electric utility industry has been kind of split apart, where the utility companies are really the distributors, and there are independent companies, kind of sort of independent companies that are very much associated with the old utilities, that are the generating companies that own all kinds of power plants, coal, oil, gas, and nuclear plants, plus windmills. I mean, FPNL is one of the largest owners and operators of windmills in the U.S.
So which one does Mr. Burns from The Simpsons own?
I'm not a Simpsons fan. As Cameron knows, I'm one of those net citizens that has little time for television.
The other anti-nuclear argument that I've heard lately, Rod, is that the world supply of uranium is likely to be exhausted within 25 to 30 years' time. Is that true?
Can I say horse shit on a podcast?
Yeah, sure.
Shit, no.
I rarely cuss, except when I hear something like that. the quantity of uranium that is available is incredibly vast compared to the amount of uranium that we use every year to produce power. One of the things that's amazing to me is that right now the fuel or the material that we pull out of commercial reactors in the U.S. still contains 95% to 97% of the initial stored energy. And we pull it out and we call it waste without worrying about recycling it. Australia, for example, has 40% of the world's known uranium, yet they have a policy in place that they will only allow 3 uranium mines to be open and operating. And part of that is really to make sure that the 3 mines that are owned, that are still operating, are profitable by keeping down the competition.
So, I mean, why don't we recycle this waste at the moment?
The guys who know how to make the calculations to produce reactors that are more efficient and can recycle the waste are the same guys that sell the fuel bundles today. And no, the reality is that they will tell you that if you, they know how to recycle, they can recycle, but it would cost about 20% more than the fuel that is made from virgin materials, which is not unusual. Almost all recycled products cost a little bit more than products from virgin material, as long as you have plenty of virgin material around. You know, paper made from recycled paper products is more expensive than cutting down trees and making paper from fresh trees. The other issue here in the U.S. is that we had a recycling industry that was up and just starting to become profitable. We had three plants that were operating, and just as the most modern plant was ready to go online, the president, by executive order, stopped all recycling. That was 1976, and the president who signed the initial order was Gerald Ford. Soon after that, Jimmy Carter made it a permanent ban on recycling. He called it reprocessing, and he said it was because he was afraid that recycling the material would result in the proliferation of nuclear weapons.
I don't get that argument. How does one thing lead to the other?
The way that you recycle the materials in the old school way, there are better ways today, but the way that you recycled it was to chemically separate the materials that could fission easily from those that take a little bit more effort to fission. And those that fission easily coming out of a nuclear reactor are plutonium and uranium-235. You separate those from the uranium-238 in the old-style recycling. Having those separate materials, and then you mix those materials back up with uranium-238. It's a weird process, but anyway, there's a period of time where those materials are separated, and those are, in some people's minds, weapons-usable materials. They aren't very good for weapons. They're kind of troublesome. They require a very sophisticated engineering process to turn them into weapons. Plus, you have to somehow wrest those away from the people that control them. But that was his philosophy. And so, it didn't stop anybody else from recycling. The Japanese and the French and the British all recycle their fuel.
Okay, so if we don't recycle, how long will the world supplies of uranium last us?
My best guess, if we don't recycle, is it'd last probably 150 to 200 years, and that's without starting to use the materials that are available in the ocean. The ocean has a pretty significant concentration of uranium in it that can be processed, as long as you're willing to spend about $200 per pound for uranium, which is still very competitive when you consider that uranium has 2 million times as much energy as an equivalent weight of oil.
All right. Well, I think that's a half-hour discussion on atomic. That's probably enough to get people thinking and reading. We should do some technology news. Thanks for helping us through that, Rod. It's good stuff, mate. And people can check out your podcast at atomic.thepodcastnetwork.com. Which will also link them through to your blogs, your other blogs, and your sites, and all that kind of stuff.
Thank you, Cameron. Have a good evening.
Thanks, buddy. You take care. Bye-bye.
Rod, cheers.
Cheers, man.
Excuse me, Scott. Do you know how I can get more out of my digital camera?
Sure I do, Michael. Listen to the Digital Photography Show on the Podcast Network. Every week, they have terrific tips and tricks for improving your digital images, as well as the latest scoop on the newest cameras, software, and other accessories to make your digital images great. They even have interviews with famous photographers and writers and lots of fun contests. You should give it a try.
Sounds perfect. Where would I find the Digital Photography Show?
Just go to digifoto.thepodcastnetwork.com.
How did you find out about the Digital Photography Show?
Well, I'm the host, and Michael, you're the co-host.
Oh, that's right.
The Digital Photography Show. Listening's a snap.
G'day, Cam.
All right. Let's do some tech news to finish up the week, Fang.
All right.
What has taken your interest lately?
Oh, shit, was I supposed to prepare something? You go first.
Good on you.
Now, I'll tell you what's taken my interest lately. A friend of mine has been in China and trying to do some blogging and podcasting out of there, and I've been trying to help with some back channel ways to get information out, and we were stymied at every turn. And she's put a really interesting blog post up today about some of the stuff she saw and did over in Vietnam and China. It's very thought-provoking stuff, and that's got me thinking about what we could or should do to help people have a voice in places like that.
And what did you come up with?
I don't know. I'm just starting to think. What do you reckon, Cam? What should we do? Should we get all subversive and find ways to get message out, or is that going to do more harm than good? What should we do here?
Mate, I haven't spent a lot of time thinking about China, actually. I mean, you know, I think one thing that we know about the net so far is it tends to enable people to find ways to express themselves and to skirt around regulatory limitations.
Yep.
Obviously, it's, you know, there's some danger of that in places like China, but, you know, I can't understand why it isn't easier for people to blog anonymously in places like China and, you know, to be able to route around some of the restrictions that MSN Spaces and companies like that agreed to when they went into China. You know, you couldn't have the word democracy in the title of your blog, etc.
Mm.
I mean, what's starting somebody operating a blog that's based out of, you know, Europe and calling it whatever the hell they want? I haven't quite investigated enough to figure out what levels of control the Chinese have over access to the net by people in China. But
yeah, I think the net of it is you have to be reasonably geeky to work to route around the various things that are in place. So average Joe Blow who goes over there as a writer is effectively blocked because it's hard. You know, if things like Google and Gmail go away, that's effectively the internet not being there.
Yeah.
Mm, interesting. Anyway, process that. Think about that. Discuss that over the years to come. It's important, but you know, you just can't ignore. I don't know. I don't know what to do with it.
Some other news from the last few days. The Senate, a U.S. Senate panel, narrowly rejected strict net neutrality rules on Wednesday, dealing a grave setback to companies like eBay, Google, and Amazon.com that have made enacting them a top political priority this year, according to CNET. You know, I guess after the House of Reps in the U.S. didn't vote for net neutrality a few weeks ago, everyone was kind of hoping that the Senate would come through and save the day. Now looks like they're not going to do that. So it looks like the net neutrality bill is not going to be passed, which basically means we're up for that interesting time where our worst fears may come true. They may not come true. We don't really know, but it pretty much means the telcos are going to have the ability, at least in the US, to, you know, and usually this sort of policy stuff that happens in the US spreads around the globe. It means they're going to have the ability to sort of hobble websites if they want. They'll be able to make certain websites who pay a toll faster in terms of performance than websites that don't pay the toll, which obviously means that the larger companies with more money, more funds, will be able to afford faster access. Now, they've always been able to buy bigger pipes and bigger networks and all of that kind of stuff, which makes, you know, marginal difference in terms of uptime and throughput and performance speeds if you're driving, you know, certain kinds of applications, bandwidth-intensive applications. But yeah, pretty much most people these days can afford to host a blog, host a podcast. It doesn't cost you a lot of money, and you can get, you know, reasonably fast access. But what the telcos now have the ability to do is to interfere with that level playing field of access.
Particularly in the new media world, you know, things like bandwidth can really prevent a podcast network from blossoming or a home TV station from thriving, can't it?
Yeah.
So we get back to that, let's create artificially a scarce resource that we can then create an economy off.
Yep.
What do you think about what are you going to do with your free porn filter, Cam? We live in Australia, we're all going to get a free porn filter, I hear.
Really? I missed that.
You missed that? Oh, there's some tech news. Yeah. Ms. Coonan was out there being so proud of the fact that they're investing lots of our taxpayers' money in giving every family a free porn filter.
Now, if it was a free porn finder, I think it'd be a lot more interesting.
Well, apparently the first, I was talking to some teachers about this yesterday, the first thing one of their younger kids did with this on a trial program was to find the list of rude words, so it basically is. But I don't know, that to me isn't the answer either. I mean, gee whiz, it's hard. I don't know, if I was a government, I wouldn't know what to do to try and help and not interfere. It's easy to criticise all these ham-fisted attempts, but what is a smart thing for a government to do? Just back right off?
Yeah, it's not the role of the government to get involved in stuff like this.
Mm.
You know, it's up...
The government shouldn't govern.
Well, that's not governing.
Well, that's slowing things down, isn't it? It's what a governor does on my go-kart.
Interfering in... I have a basic issue with control mechanisms and with censorship generally, you know.
Yeah.
People should self-censor. I don't believe in government censorship. I believe in self-censorship. And you know, if you're a parent, you know, censoring your kids. I mean, there are already stuff out there you can get if you want a net nanny, but, you know, I'm personally, as a parent, quite happy for my kids to look at whatever they want to look at. Yeah,
I'm not, but I ain't going to put a net nanny on to try and stop it. You know, we talk about it as a family when it happens.
Yeah.
Deal with it that way, yeah.
Exactly. You talk to your kids and you educate your kids. And, yeah, look, at the end of the day, if your kids really want to get to porn, they're going to get at it. You're not going to stop them. It's the same with pretty much anything. I mean, kids are going to get to stuff. I had a massive collection of Playboys when I was 12. You know, kids are going to get to stuff if they want to get to it. That doesn't matter what you do, you're not going to stop them.
That's right. And the end game is generally to try and procreate and prolong the species, isn't it? It seems to be fairly well hardwired in all of us.
I kept them in an old school port in the hidden, I thought, in the we had a big park, a spare allotment next to our house in Bundaberg, and I kept them buried in the weeds out there in this old school case, thinking they were safe, until my dad happened to be mowing the grass out there one day and found them.
Sprinkled all over the neighborhood.
I got into all manner of trouble over that, I tell you.
Man. Well, such is life. But yeah, I guess the government shouldn't have been out there trying to stop all cases in backyards, should they? That wouldn't have done the trick.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Google has released an account authentication proxy for web-based applications, which is basically like Microsoft Passport, the original vision for Microsoft Passport, which never really got off the ground too well. But this is a way of websites being able to plug into an API that Google is providing that enables you to authenticate your users against their Google account. Which is a good thing. You know, we were just talking on the show, I think, sometime in the last couple of weeks about the fact that, you know, it's 2006 and we still don't have a standard way of authenticating against accounts. So we all have hundreds of thousands of passwords and logins and all this kind of shit. And, you know, just even at TPN, I have people all the time forgetting or losing their login to our intranet or to our, you know, our blogs for this, the hosts I'm talking about. If there was a standard way across the industry of making that work, it would make life so much easier. And, Microsoft, when they tried to introduce this, as you remember, Fang, back in sort of 98, 99, 2000.
Hailstorm.
Yeah, Hailstorm. Mm. Got absolutely body slammed by the industry, led by Sun and Oracle and friends and Netscape, I think, back in the day. And they came up with their, you know, their sort of federated model, which... You know, I was saying on the show, it never took off, and I haven't seen it, but then Rich sent me something after that, sent me a link to a website indicating that there's like a million sites that are now using it, but I haven't come across one in my
daily travels. No, it's pretty useful. And I used to be a big disciple of the federated stuff up until this year, because I thought if you just got enough big federated directories federated, then the problem would go away as for an end user. And that's, you know, the Google Wallets kind of, or the Google whatever they're calling it, is an approach to that. But there's a guy out there called Descartes from Skip SXIP, who we got to get on the show, who's turning it inside out and thinking about identity 2.0. And it's really hard to articulate, but in my mind, he's the rock star. He knows what has to be done to make a user-centric, scalable Web 2-ish way of dealing with this problem.
Hmm.
So it's a big issue. But do you want the cynical view on the Google stuff?
Yeah.
You know why they're doing it?
Why?
So they can sell prime advertising space inside your wallet. So they're basically going to keep, you know, my credit card on file and my let my Google log on work on more sites, which I'm all for. I'll be bang up for this. But what's going to happen is when I go into my Google wallet to use my credentials in a transaction, they'll be able to whack in AdSense words right there and then. And I'd hate to think what the bill is going to cost to get an ad placed in someone's wallet. it's prime advertising real estate in my mind.
Yeah, it is. So you're right. And
good on them.
I don't have a problem with them.
No.
There's a new online piece of software that I heard about just in the last few days. I think Mike Arrington might have mentioned it. It's called Gliffy. Yeah, it's an online version of Visio. There's a couple of these out there now. Ajax Sketch, I think, is another one that I looked at. Bunch of, you know, ASP type applications that enable you to do diagrams and flowcharts and that kind of stuff. Fairly limited, obviously, yet again in feature set and what they can do, but they will enable you to do a basic one, and most of the more popular things that you need to accomplish with these are built in, and I'm sure they'll all grow and expand in time. Another thing that's interesting is that NBC has announced that they're going to be partnering with YouTube to promote NBC's television lineup for fall in the US, and they're sponsoring a contest related to some new network show. So, you know, that's more support for YouTube and doing digital video, which is fantastic to see from the big networks. Again, I tend to think that by supporting the YouTubes of the world, these guys are signing their own death warrant. But you know, it's good for YouTube and good for people that want to watch video online. That's for sure.
Well, it's good for that level playing field and citizen created content, isn't it? I've just put up my old digital video stuff that I did back in 1990 with my old mate Nick Hodge, who we must talk to one day.
Yeah.
And you know, the stuff that I used to have to carry around on a 100 megabyte external hard disk in the old days, and Nick and I had those, and we were the uber geeks, and I could show people my digital video. And then it got to the stage where I could keep it on my hard disk all the time and show people from my laptop. And then I could show it on my PDA or my phone. But now it's on YouTube and I can just shoot people the URLs and it just plays. It's
awesome.
Cool.
Awesome.
You should get in and have a look. It's heartwarming stuff. My firstborn's first steps in postage stamp size videos. But it's really great to be able to share that with people easily, isn't it?
It is.
Bang up for it. Good stuff.
Good stuff. All right, mate. Well, I think that's all the news I've really got today that's captured my attention. If you don't have anything else, that might be a show. I've got stuff to do.
Something is rattling in my brain, but it is stuck behind my inarticulate voice box, so we'll get to that another time.
All right. Thank you for joining me today, Fang.
It's my very great pleasure. And when's your mate Rich back? When can I have my life back?
Oh, as if you're not begging me to come on the show every day.
I didn't say I wasn't, but it's just such a thrill that it's just distracting me.
Yeah. I don't know. I think he's not back till next week sometime. First week.
I haven't heard from him. Am I missing some sort of a channel? Is he off the air, or what's the story?
He was. He's around. He's busy going to conferences and doing stuff. And yeah, no,
I wanted to talk about. That's what I want to talk about. Feed Jumbler. I've finally found a tool that lets me grab multiple RSS feeds and shove them out one of my own RSS feeds. So that, and I think this is really important, and if there's a better one out there, someone please tell me, but I just stumbled across one called Feed Jumbler, and so I pour all my favourite feed burner feeds about me in there, and you can subscribe to everything from me in one hit. I can add more stuff in there, take it, move it around. I think that's goodness. I think that's coolness.
Cool.
There you go.
Sounds good, mate.
Now I can let you go. Now we've got ourselves a show.
All right, mate. Have a good weekend. And
we'll do.
Everybody.
Hang in there, buddy.
Talk to you next week. See you later, world.
Goodbye, world and earth.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.